If you love Star Wars and love the excitement of chasing your favorite Star Wars collectibles, the Star Wars Digital Card Trader Collecting app from Topps is for you. Collect and trade with friends new and old through the Star Wars Digital Card Trader Collecting app from Topps. These are the cards you're looking for.
This is Master Obi-Wan Kenobi. I regret to report that both our Jedi Order and the Republic have fallen. Our future is uncertain. But in time, a new hope will emerge.
Coffee with Kenobi presents Rebels Reactions with Dan Z and Corey Club.
All troopers, focus your fire on... on the Jedi.
Come with us. Learn what it truly means to be a Jedi.
I'm in space! And I'm about to die!
We need an opening.
Found one!
What did he say?
He said hello, hyperspace.
Oh, and guess what? This is the podcast you're looking for.
Welcome back to Rebels Reactions. This is your host, Aaron Harris, and we have a great lineup tonight as we go through and review Ghosts of Geonosis. That's right. We are back from the Christmas holiday break from Rebels, and we kick off with this tremendous episode, which is a great tie-in to Rogue One. So if you haven't seen Rogue One, you probably don't want to watch this episode yet. Because this is definitely ties directly into Rogue One, as we have the premiere of Saw Gerrera in the Rebels universe. So a lot of fun happening tonight. And joining us for this tremendous discussion tonight, of course, we have Dennis Keithley joining us. How are you doing, Dennis?
I am doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
No, my pleasure. I'm glad you're able to join us this week. And also joining us is, of course, Jay Krebs. Jay, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron. Hey, Dennis. Doing great. Can't wait to dig in.
Oh, definitely. It's going to be fun to dig into this episode. A lot of exciting things happened. A lot of ties into Rogue One. And just a lot of story to fill in, a lot of background for information that we liked. A lot of little tidbits in there. So we won't hesitate to... Ghost of Geonosis, of course, takes place on Geonosis. Our rebels are dispatched to do a search and rescue for a rebel group that went to try to investigate what happened on Geonosis. And that's where we find leading that pack was Saw Gerrera. And we get this rebels wind up bumping into one Geonosian who's protecting an egg, as they try to discover what happened to the rest of the Geonosian bug people. Because as you know from Attack of the Clones, there were millions and millions of them everywhere. But it was a lot of fun and a lot of exciting things happen. Of course, we have the Empire show up and try to stop our rebels in their place. A lot of great action, a lot of great background. And let's just go ahead and jump right into this discussion. We are back on Geonosis for the first time since the last season with the Honorable Ones, when Zeb and Agent Kallus were marooned on one of the moons of Geonosis, and they discovered then, of course, that there was no life on Geonosis as they could find, that they could find or they scan for or locate. So because of that, our rebels get dispatched out there. And it was nice to return to Geonosis. I mean, I think Rex said it best. He hoped he never had to return to this Dust Bowl, but he did. How did it feel being back on Geonosis, Dennis?
Well, it was unusual. They landed in a sandstorm, which made it very difficult for them. And as you mentioned, there's places typically crawling with millions and millions of bugs, and they didn't find anything. And of course, they were there on a mission to follow up on Saw. So it was certainly different. I mean, in a way, it was kind of like many other desert worlds that we've seen, Tatooine or Jakku or something like that, just utterly lifeless and mysterious at the same time.
It definitely was. And you could tell, obviously, there was a lot of, once the storm started to clear, there was a lot of damage, a lot of destruction to Geonosis. What kind of impression did that make on you, Jay?
Well, the first thing I thought of was from Attack of the Clones, when we see the Geonosian arena and just the heyday of the architecture that was there at the time, and just knowing that that was probably all lost when the Geonosians were wiped out. And my mind went right away to Catalyst, which I'm sure probably both of you have read that book, yes?
Oh, yes.
No.
Oh, Aaron, what are you waiting for, dude?
I'm running behind.
It's okay. You're allowed. But there's, and Dennis, I'm sure that you'll echo my sentiments when I say that there's a lot of tie-ins to Catalyst with this one as well.
Yeah, indeed there was. You know, as we learned, well, I mean, that there's hints towards, and this is Rogue One as well, but the, you know, the, this is where the birthplace of the Death Star was. And of course, when they showed up here last season for the Honorable Ones, as Aaron was mentioning earlier, they, there were signs of something having been built in orbit around the planet, which creates a huge mystery. And, you know, well, I guess we'll get to that shortly, but, you know, that's why they're there, to find Saw. And it is, the whole place is it's spooky when they get there, because, you know, they get into those tunnels and those chasms, and there's just obviously something's happened. And, you know, we were used to an Attack of the Clones seeing the Geonosians pile on top of each other in those tunnels and catacombs, and they're just not there.
No, they're not. They're nowhere to be found either. The search high and low, of course, turns up only one survivor, it appears, who of course Ezra lovingly names Click Clack. Obviously a lone Geonosian. He's done everything he can just to stay alive. Imagine being the last of your species. I can imagine only how lonely that could possibly be. The Empire did do a number on, and they did a huge cleanup job too on Geonosis after the incidents in Honorable Ones. I remember in that episode that around the orbit of the planet, there was tons of debris. You could tell there was a huge project occurring there, and it was all gone. It was all cleaned up. Somehow it was all gone, which is not an easy task when you're dealing with that much space debris, I'm sure. I can only imagine how long it took for the Empire to clean that up.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing was, is that I can't remember exactly where the reference was, if it was a catalyst, but they used a lot of the asteroids and the rings around Geonosis as construction material for the Death Star. And I didn't get a chance to really notice whether or not you could see that in those opening scenes as they're landing there. But yeah, the station that they briefly visited in the Honorable Ones is gone. There was just no sign that the Empire was there, which compounds the mystery. And of course, they have no idea what was happening there. And they still have no idea what was happening there after this episode.
No, not at all. And it's not from lack of trying either. When they, of course, go back to Click Clack at this point, where they catch him, and of course, they're trying to get information. Well, Saul's trying to get information from him. A little more harshly than everybody else, but we'll dig into Saul's character here in a little bit. But Click Clack goes down into the dirt. He draws that circle within a circle. And, of course, there's a dozen different ways to interpret that through this episode. The gas canisters at the end, the egg. Of course, first time I saw it, drew it like everybody else, I'm sure everybody's mind went to one thing, because we all just saw Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Death Star. Yep. And so he's telling them what they want to know, but they're not understanding. Imagine right. How much different the story would be if they would have actually made that connection at this point rather than through the events of Rogue One.
Right. Yes, it would have been so different for sure. And you're right. My mind went right to the Death Star, and he's like, it's right in front of you. He's telling you exactly what you want to know. But of course, there's that communication barrier there. So...
Well, and they also have no reference for mm-hmm. this at all. There's no idea that there's a Death Star. You know, they've they have, you know, this show has demonstrated that the Empire has been collecting Kyber crystals back in season one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've had other mysteries going on, which on Lothal, which we've come to learn is the TIE Defender. But they've hinted that they're building something, but there hasn't been enough clues that have tied everything together. I think it was somewhere on Twitter that I saw that Pablo or someone else from the creative team was mentioning at one point Chopper was going to roll across that picture that Click-Clack drew in the dust. And so it was going to look ahead the trench going through the middle of it, which would have been cool, but they still would have known what that was because they have no reference for it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's, to this point, there's no point of reference for this weapon. They just know that they don't even know they're building a weapon. They just know the Empire is building something, and it's obviously something big. And it's very interesting because even in one of the scenes in when they're on Geonosis in Click-Clack's little living space hangar area where they got the computer and that's where they find their egg, there's actually a clip where he's standing there, Click-Clack next to Ezra, and if you look over his shoulder, there's a piece of debris that's right there. And it looks just like a model of the Death Star. It's got the spherical pattern. It's got a little smaller spherical in it. It looks like the Death Star, just almost Ooh. Like a model of it. So there's a lot of clues in this thing that if people knew where they were looking, would have made a world of difference in the Star Wars universe and the Star Wars saga.
I'll have to pay attention to that next time. I didn't see that. That was a good catch. Well, there was a lot going on.
there was a lot going on in that scene. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, I didn't catch it till the second time I watched it. Because when he first walks in, I am looking, and my eyes are immediately drawn to the first generation clone trooper helmet mm-hmm. from Attack right. of the Clones, as well as other memorabilia he got there. So we definitely have a Click-Clack trying to extend the life of his species. I mean, he's got this queen egg. And definitely you see the difference between what's going on in the rebellion at this point with how everybody wants to handle Click-Clack. You have Saw who wanting to be a little bit more forceful and interrogating of the process, while of course our rebels are being themselves. They're trying to be conserve the they're trying to come at it from a human point of view and almost give it a more peaceful, a more negotiable type conversation with this guy and try to get more information out of him that way. And if that made any sense whatsoever, I'm shocked.
No, it did.
I'm thinking about what I just said. And I'm like, man, that just does not make sense to me.
Well, Saw is not empathetic at all. He's trying to fight fire with fire, and he sees the Empire has established itself through drastic measures, and so he's willing to use those drastic measures to fight them. Unfortunately, you know, he sees the Geonosians as still part of that separatist movement that he was fighting against way back in the Clone Wars as well. And, you know, they're not people to him. They're his enemy. And, you know, he's going to do whatever it is he has to get done. Meanwhile, like you said, Hera and the crew of the Ghost don't think that way. I think Ezra says it best. If you're willing to result to their methods, you're just no better than the Empire, which is kind of a takeoff of Jen Erso's line in Rogue One, which is, you know, you're no better than a stormtrooper if all you're doing is following orders.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And the more we go through this review, I'm realizing the more we just cannot wait to go into Saw Gerrera. We need to go ahead and talk about Saw, because the more we get into this episode, the more we're going to have to dig into his character anyway. So we might as well go ahead and get some discussion in on Saw, because this, of course, is the first we saw him in Rogue One. And that was the first time we had seen him since the Clone Wars and the Onderon arc. And we've seen him grow up quite a bit since then. Of course, this was an exciting episode because this was the show. This show is what broke the news that Saw was coming back in an animated form as well, which was exciting finally to see the episode. With Saul's return, what was the biggest impact of Saul's return for you, Jay?
Well, of course, his visual presence was a big part of it for me. And just seeing the way that they were able to encapsulate his look and tying it into Rogue One especially, but also hearkening back to the Clone Wars days, like you said, in the Onderon arc as well. And there's been one thing definitely visually that's been kind of weighing on me, and I know that it's been kind of a point of discussion and debate, and that is his eye color, of course. And, you know, we started out with the Clone Wars, and he had these blue eyes. And in Rogue One, they're Forrest Whitaker's eyes, so they're brown eyes. And they're sort of this kind of green now. They're sort of in between. So I'm wondering if that was just simply a creative decision or if there's a reason behind it, such as, and I know that he's human, but would his eyes change color as he aged? Someone I was having a discussion on Twitter had said, could it have been the pesticide? You know, it got to his lungs. Could it possibly have affected his eye color as well? Because I often wondered why they wouldn't have made the decision to just put contacts in Forrest Whitaker. You know, what was the reason for keeping the brown eyes as opposed to going back, especially for those of us that know the Clone Wars so much, and giving him blue eyes? So what do you guys think?
Honestly, I remember that being brought up during the teaser and the trailer that he first appeared in. And it was something I stuck in the back of my mind, but I actually haven't gotten back to that. I think mainly because I haven't watched that Onderon arc in so long. I think there's something to it, and given a chance, we'll get an explanation of why they didn't from the story group, is why there is a difference and why they didn't correct for that somewhere along the line. I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, you know, at this point, maybe from hanging out on Geonosis, he's been exposed to trace elements of that gas. But I don't, he still seems otherwise healthy. His voice is not the same way as it was in Rogue One. He hasn't sustained the same injuries. So he's not crippled in the fact that he's got artificial legs the same way he does in the movie. So I'm not certain.
I feel like there's a reason behind it, though, because I think, you know, the story group knows how careful we all are with details.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what I mean? And that we will zero in on the smallest of details. So I feel like there's got to be a story behind that. And I'm sorry for, you know, harping on this or spending so much time on Saw's eye color. But, you know, it really does kind of bother me, I guess, in a way. Why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? I need an answer. So who knows? Maybe we'll get one. Maybe not.
I'm sure we will at some point. There's got to be a reason behind it, or else they would not have done it. They're very meticulous in how they do things. The story group is mysterious, the ways of the story group. But they do. They know what they're up against when they deal with the fans. So they know what's going on. They know that they're going to do everything they can at that point to explain everything out. And there's going to be a reason. Oh, we may not get it now. We may not get it in animated form. We may get it in a comic book, just like we found out about the 3PO's red arm from a comic book. So there's, it'd be one of those, maybe there's one of those small details they'll just have to throw into a comic book just to appease the fans at that point to get the information out. Cause they're not going to spend the time on an animated show or, of course in a movie to reveal that.
All right. So we need a Saw Gerrera one shot. That's what we need.
That's pretty much what we're going to be looking for. Cause I'm sure we will get it. Cause I'm sure there's going to be more that tells his story from this point on between the Geonosis and Rogue One. That's going to have to come out. Because there's a lot there. I mean, his appearance between this episode and Rogue One, of course, has drastically changed. He has, of course, the mechanical leg, their feet. He's gone a little crazier than he has. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with being right there on the front lines of the war. And hats off to to Forrest Whitaker, because he did a tremendous job portraying the sane side of Forrest. Of course, he plays the sane Forrest all the time. the sane side of Saul in this episode, but beginning to show how he's slowly going into that crazed extremist Saul that we see in Rogue One. That, of course, is discussed and why he's not a part of the actual alliance itself. It is a tremendous performance by him. What connected you the most to Saul between this episode and Rogue One? What did you see that really connected with you, Dennis?
Well, it's not so much what I saw from Saul, but everyone's reaction to him. At one point, Hera pulls Kanan aside and says, "I don't know what you've heard about him or what you know about him, but the Alliance is concerned about him and his actions and his efforts." So we saw those first hints that he's an extremist. He's the outsider, which, you know, we didn't get too much of in the movie, other than his willingness to submit Bodhi Rook to the Borgullet. And then later in this episode, we kind of got more of that answer, when he was torturing Click Clack and threatening to destroy that egg if he didn't get what he wanted, which was to take Click Clack off and get answers about what was going on in Geonosis. So, that extremism that's been talked about, I think that is the connective tissue.
Very good. Very good. Now, of course, we know a lot of his background from the Clone Wars with the Onderon arc, and of course how he got into freedom fighting with his sister Stila, and of course her loss at the end of the Onderon arc affected him. We see that as he still carries her picture around, or her hologram, as you should say, around with him as he's doing, and of course Ezra winds up getting a hold of that and talking about how they wind up talking about her a little bit in that. And it was very good. It's nice to see them reference Stila and actually show her again from the Clone Wars. And she looked like she had changed a bit. Of course, I know she hasn't, because she died in that episode series. But she definitely gave a lot of background that we did not have. A few people who had not seen the Clone Wars arc got that background on him. Now, his fighting skills are pretty much the same. I mean, we definitely see him go through. He's still just as cocky as he ever was from the Clone Wars, still in this episode. We see that when he comes barreling through the wall, blasting the droids. We see that on top of the ghosts as they're blasting the flying stormtroopers, which Ezra finally got his flying stormtroopers, didn't he? from a previous episode. So definitely he's got that same cocky fighting style, but that he learned from the Jedi back then, and he's improved on it. Even Rex was happy to see him again and see how much he's grown. And apparently they've been in touch since Rex joined the rebellion. And apparently even Rex was offered asked to go on this mission and declined it. what do you think about that one, Jay?
Well, it's probably a good thing that he didn't go. And I'm still wondering what happened to the rest of Saw's group. I guess we'll probably get that answer in a future episode. But, how many people did he have in his group, and where did they all go? I mean, that was kind of an unresolved thing there.
For the most part, yes, pretty unresolved. I mean, he did say he was ambushed by the droids as well. So just like Ezra and Kanan and Rex were, but apparently his crew was not keen on escaping the droids. And definitely they were killed. I mean, we probably could count how many were in his group from all the helmets lying around if we went back and watched it, which I should have done, but I even thought about it, but I didn't. I ran out of time. But definitely there's definitely that mystery there of what did happen to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me wonder, it just seemed too perfect that there were everyone's helmets laying around. You know what I'm saying? Like, how could everyone lose their helmet? So is there some sort of maybe setup going on here that, you know, we don't know about? That was the where my mind went. So I don't know if I'm trying to read too much into it, or, you know, if that was just what it was supposed to be, or if there's more to the story.
Was Saw perhaps leaving those helmets as breadcrumbs in case someone did come looking for them? Because I kind of got the impression he was stranded on Geonosis, and now this part may be speculation on my behalf, but I don't think he had a way off that planet, so he would have been stranded, and he couldn't necessarily stay in one place if there was battle droids around. So were those helmets left there for someone to draw attention if another group rebel came out? I mean, I don't have a definitive answer there, but that kind of what struck me is perhaps this was, you know, another rebel group was going to notice those helmets. Because you're right, it is odd. That's the only thing lying around. Not anyone's blasters. Not, you know, God forbid their bodies. But that's something there that those rebels, Kanan and anyone else that showed up would have noticed.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm going to counter that. I think that, and this is my personal opinion, I have nothing to back this up, but my theory is that that's not where Saw was ambushed. I'm thinking Saw and his team were ambushed somewhere else. And after Saw escaped and the rest of his team died, that Click Clack actually took those helmets because they led to a dead end. There was nowhere for Ezra or Kanan or Rex or Chopper to escape to. So it led them into a trap, into a dead end. So I'm thinking Click Clack actually took those and actually planted those to try to, as part of his plan to protect the queen egg that he was trying to protect.
To throw off the trail, so to speak.
Exactly. And it's he has a bigger chance of success when he's dealing with a trapped prey versus a mobile prey.
Mm-hmm. And how was it that Click Clack was the only one left? It almost makes me wonder, too, could there be others of his kind? I mean, it's a big planet. So could there be others of their kind? Or was this simply that the Empire just really did miss one? It reminds me of them hunting down the Jedi. And here's Click Clack, and he's got this egg, and the queen egg is so special. It's almost like the Jedi that were hunted down, but yet there were still some left, and they were protecting the precious, like, queen egg, I guess you could say, of the Force. So I made that connection too, but could there be other Geonosians that got missed, or is he really the only one left?
He very well could be the only one left. I would like to think there were others. I think that even came up as a discussion in the episode. Could there be others on the planet, especially when he's making that escape into that hole there at the end? They're talking about how ingenious the people they are. It definitely could be one of those things where he's the only one we encountered. He could be the one. He could be the Obi-Wan Kenobi, christened to watch over and guard over their hope. As Obi-Wan was over Luke. So it could be a situation similar to that, and there are others elsewhere. Or it could just literally be he is the last samurai. He's it. He is everything that's left of their species. I mean, there's no answer to that question at this point. We don't know.
Well, I would actually push back on that one a little bit. And the reason being is because I'm only considering canon material outside the show and the movies now. And over the past 2 years, we had the Darth Vader comic, and which takes place after A New Hope, and Darth Vader returned to Geonosis, and there were still no Geonosians there, and he encountered a queen who was no longer capable of reproducing, so she was putting together droids. So sorry if this is a spoiler for anyone, but the issue's also been out for nearly 2 years. I don't think that there necessarily was any other Geonosians around for that reason. And I guess the other thing is that it's why Click Clack? If this is a contingency plan, if the Geonosians knew they were being wiped out and they had to protect an egg, you would have thought it would have been their biggest, baddest warrior that would have been protecting the thing. Click-Clack did not strike me as that. He struck me as more of a drone, as someone who's far more innocent, and, you know, had an awesome responsibility thrust upon him once the situation came to be. So I don't know. I think that this seems a little bit accidental to me, that that he may have been it. For some reason, he was able to avoid the Empire's efforts, and he's found this awesome responsibility, and he's been doing his best to protect his species' future.
Perfect. And I'm glad you shared that, because I have yet to read the Darth Vader comics. They're actually on my iPad ready to read. I haven't started them yet, though. So definitely I'm glad you brought that up. Except it does make something, makes some more sense there. That this very well could be the last of the last. The one that slipped through everybody's fingers that they didn't know existed.
Yeah, indeed. I don't know. I feel bad for the Geonosians. I mean, you know, they are largely a faceless enemy in Attack of the Clones because, you know, let's face it, they pretty much all do look alike. And I think that was by design. They're bugs. They're something that we find as a nuisance. But as they come to realize over the course of this episode, yeah, they deserve a chance to live and, have their families and just exist the same as everybody else. It took, Saw all episode to realize that. But, it was largely unfair what happened to them, of course.
Oh, very much. Very much. And it's definitely, hopefully we'll get to see what happened to Click-Clack and the Queen Egg in the future, whether it be probably not through Rebels, but through something in the future with Star Wars. Maybe we'll wind up back on Geonosis again. You never know. They do like going to their desert planets, don't they?
Mm-hmm. This is true. Staple.
Yeah, it's desert planets are a staple in Star Wars, that is for sure. So we got a whole bunch of stuff going on. Of course, while Kanan and Ezra and Chopper are in the catacombs and the caves going through looking for Saw Gerrera and everything that's happening there, we have Zeb and we have Sabine trying to track down an energy source that had been reported on the planet's surface, and they wind up finding one of those nice deflector shield generators like we see in Return of the Jedi, or excuse me, Empire Strikes Back. I got the movies confused. Got the Empire Strikes Back there, which actually gives them the opportunity to do some salvaging, actually, and remove the shield, the core, and move it to try to get a shield for Chopper Base, which I got a feeling we're going to see that come in handy here in the future. But in the course of that, of course, they're in that storm. And as the storm clears, they realize that they are surrounded by a bunch of destroyers. That's not a good nightmare to wake up to, is it?
No, not at all.
Definitely, it's we see a lot of interesting things from Sabine in this episode. Of course, as they're going through the sandstorm, she's worried about how the sandstorm's going to mess up her paint job. That's all she's concerned about. Who cares what else is out there? It's going to mess up her paint job. And what really jumped out at me in this episode is she got her jetpack fixed. And of course we are, well, this ghost is hiding in a air duct or a ventilation shaft for the caves below. The Imperials are got them blocked in and got them trapped. They're sending all these new troopers that we see down in there, the rocket troopers, or I believe is what they called them, down into the hole to try to stop them, or jump troopers is what they're calling them, excuse me, down there to try to stop the ghost and destroy it and do it. And Kanan and Ezra, Saw, Zeb, they're all up top shooting and lightsaber fighting, trying to keep them away. And it takes Sabine coming out and just flying around, and within moments really takes charge of the situation. Even Ezra's like, oh, they're in trouble now. when she comes out. How exciting, and I know you're a big Mandalorian fan, Jay. How exciting was it to see Sabine in her element with that pack in that fight.
Well, you said exactly what I was going to say. She was definitely in her element, and it was so great to see her being able to utilize the tech that is, you know, so related to her heritage and just taking people down. Yeah, she had some really good one-liners in this one, and I loved when she took the Anakin Skywalker sand line. It gets everywhere.
Stupid sand.
My son and I were watching that together, and we both just looked at each other and busted out laughing. That was perfect. But yeah, it was great seeing Sabine do what she does best, for sure.
It was definitely fun, and Sabine had a lot of fun in this episode. You obviously could tell that, and definitely really put her front and center on when it comes to combat. In this episode, dealing with the, of course, not only the deflector shield, but with those jump troopers, and she does quite well. I mean, between throwing the detonators and blasting the troopers, I mean, and the best part is when she finally gets done, lands back on the Ghost. Ezra's like, "I want one of those," and she's just like, "Of course you do," and just keeps walking.
I know.
I know. She just keeps going. It's like nothing, like she hasn't done anything all day, and she's like, "All right, what's next?"
One of the things I like about Sabine is that, for as obvious as they've been about Ezra's growth over the past three seasons and the Force, they've subtly let Sabine just become more and more powerful without, you know, they don't have to spend a whole lot of exposition on it. And she's always been confident and a competent warrior. And so, you know, she just came out and took care of business and landed. And it didn't have to be Ezra already knew she was great and she was going to take care of business when she flew out there. But she's always been competent and confident in what she's going to do. And so she's had an opportunity to grow without it having to be thrown in her face, kind of way with Ezra's advancement. Every time Kanan teaches him something and Ezra messes up, Sabine just goes out and takes care of her, you know, does what she needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
She truly does, and she's really gotten she has probably had the most subtle growth of all the characters in Rebels in the past, or since the series began. It's been very subtle, very quiet. You see her, you can pinpoint her growth and see her grow, but really this season she's really really built up into this fearless warrior. And I got a feeling we're going to get a lot more of that as things come, based on that mid-season trailer. We're going to see a lot more growth from Sabine, which I can't wait to see. So definitely a lot of growth for somebody who's really taken a back seat for a lot of this ride. And we see a lot of growth, too, from Kanan in this. We see him handling himself and his blindness a lot better. They even make fun of it at one point in the episode. I don't know if you caught that. When she's flying around, taking out all the jump troopers, and everybody on top of the Ghost is just standing there going, "Wow, whoa, oh!" You hear Kanan going, "What's she doing? What'd she do? What'd I miss?" Because he can't see. So he's even they're even throwing a few shots in there at Kanan indirectly, which I thought was fun, because obviously he's watching things through the Force, but apparently that's just one thing he can't see.
That's a good point, Aaron. He seems to be able to see through the Force what he needs to see, which is where an enemy is. You know, the Force tells him no, that he needs to defend himself. You know, there's a saber strike coming in from his left, or there's a blaster bolt coming in from his right. And he can do things with that. Or, you know, we saw earlier in the season, I think of the Heroes episode, where he redirected that rocket back to an AT-DP. But, you know, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't see everything, which I think this was a nice reminder that he still has this disability. He can overcome it, but it kind of like Chirrut Imwe, just because he can take advantage of the Force doesn't mean that he still can see everything around him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly, and I'm glad we're going into that, because that was something that was the reason I was bringing this up, because it shows that through it all he still has to deal with his injury, because we've seen him throughout this season after that first episode where he was really kind of mourning his injury and he had his encounter with Bindu. After that, it's kind of been a different Kanan. It's been a lot more confidence. He's been a lot more fighting, and he hasn't missed a beat in his fighting, despite his injury. And this was just a reminder of he still has this injury he has to deal with. Which brings me to that question. We know the Force is with him, and the Force is helping him overcome his disability to survive and fight and so forth. But how come it's not letting him see everything else as well? How come he can't feel where Sabina's going? He can't feel what's going on in those regards. I mean, he's still in a fight. Why couldn't he feel what she was doing at that point? Because he's got to be able to feel where his partners and where his friends and his allies are around him, so he doesn't accidentally kill them as well. So he's got to have a way to feel them out. Why couldn't he feel where she was or what she was doing?
Maybe because the Force knew that Sabine had it covered and it didn't need to waste its time making Kanan pay attention to it. You know what I mean? So maybe it's the fact that he's in tune to the things that he needs to be in tune to. Because realistically, if you've got everything going on all at once, that's almost like sensory overload. And not being able to see it, to discern between different things, it would really be overwhelming. And I think the same thing, and Dennis, when you brought up Churrit, he was able to be in tune to a lot as well, but he had Baze to watch his back. So, you know, maybe that's the way that Kanan is able to utilize. And obviously Kanan is much more trained, I guess you could say, than Churrit. As we know, Churrit was not a Jedi. So, you know, maybe that explains things a little bit.
I agree with your point, Jay. And I think the Force, he knew this was covered. He didn't have to do anything. Sabine was taking care of it. She didn't need anyone else to intercede on her behalf. And I think that lesson was driven home to Kanan earlier this season with the Bindu, who made him understand that, you know, the Force doesn't make anyone good. The Force doesn't make any bad. A lot of lessons that were learned there. But it also helped Kanan realize that Ezra's going to do what he's going to do, and Kanan can be there, but he doesn't have to be looking over his shoulder to make sure that he's safe. Kanan was concerned about endangering the team since he didn't have his sight and didn't have the full array of all of his senses. I think that comes into play here. Sabine had that, and nobody else on that team was, you know, leaping up and saying, "Oh my gosh, we got to help her." And you know, so he didn't have to know where she was. She had it handled, and he wasn't getting any indication that he needed to step in there.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Excellent. And you're very, very right. Those are good points brought up. I mean, definitely it's something definitely I'd like to see explored more as the season goes on as to the extent of what Kanan can feel and see through the Force. Definitely, I think it would be a nice touch as we go forward, because we see him do an awful lot through the Force, that it's almost, I mean, even just walking through the caves, nobody's guiding him. He's just walking like he knows where he's going. The only time they stopped him is when he, nearly walked into the abyss.
Right.
When Saw stopped him, which is, so he's got some abilities there, but it's just not apparently fully rounded.
Well, was he really going to walk into that abyss, or was Saw being overprotective because, you know, Kanan's good blind?
Good.
Just a thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I would love to see a first person perspective from Kanan's point of view, so to speak. You know, we see everything as we look on to the characters, mm-hmm. but I think it would be neat, even just a little aside as part of an episode, just to kind of see things through Kanan's Force vision, so to speak, to see what he actually sees.
I was going to say, if we're seeing what he actually sees, it'd be a very dark episode.
Well, I mean, you know, in his mind, he's obviously getting imagery. He's obviously sensing things. So to have his sensory experience, I guess you could mm-hmm. say, not see what he sees in the literal sense, but
I couldn't help it. I had to.
So. Well, and that's a good point because, you know, one of the scenes we hadn't really addressed yet that came before the whole Rocket Trooper things, when they were trying to track down Click Clack, they brought down that bridge so that, you know, he did Ezra and Kanan did the Patnus force throw across the chasm so Ezra could get over there. And then they shot down that bridge and Kanan held it in the force so that Saw and Rex could get across. Well, he knew exactly where to hold it without any guidance from those two. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he encouraged them to get across quickly because it was crumbling and he wasn't sure much how longer he could hold it. And then he knew exactly how far to leap across using his force jump. So that's a good point. I'd be interested to see, you know, what is it that he hears from the force? And, you know, is it like Daredevil? You know, he gets an idea of some sort of a sonar almost about where things are. But, you know, he's got something going on there.
Force echolocation.
I like it.
And I have to say, I'm glad you brought that scene up because that has the best line in the episode in that scene. After Kanan makes that huge leap and just walks off, and Saul looks at Rex and goes, "I forgot they could do that." And then Rex is like, "Yeah, but he's no Skywalker."
Oh, so great.
Yeah.
No Skywalker. And if you only knew.
Oh, and then of course you hear Kanan go, "I heard that.
I heard that."
just really random.
I still like the sand comment though.
Oh, the sand was great. There's a lot of comedic elements in this.
I'm just teasing. No, they're all great.
a lot of fun stuff happening in this episode. But we're going to keep going discussing Ghosts of Geonosis. First off, though, we are going to throw things over to Dan and Corey for a few moments. They want to tell us about that nice Topps Star Wars trading card app that you can get for your mobile device. So, Dan, Corey, take it away.
If you are a huge Star Wars fan, and let's face it, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are. And if you love collecting Star Wars, the Star Wars Card Trader app from Topps is for you.
The best part, the Star Wars Card Trader app features incredible images from the original trilogy, the prequels, the Clone Wars, Rebels, and The Force Awakens. Every era you love is included on the app.
It's easy and a lot of fun, too. Beloved characters, key scenes, and unforgettable moments are in every pack. Open the app every day and get free credits to spend on card packs from the Cantina, trade with your friends, and make new ones along the way as you continue to add to your Star Wars collection. And it's all free.
The variety makes it fun, too. So chase what you love. Some of the latest packs include poster series, classic comic book series, helmet variety packs, and so much more. There are even exclusive cards you can get by completing sets, as well as special inserts and even autograph opportunities. Don't worry about missing the cards you love either, as you sign up for notifications right on the app.
The Star Wars Digital Card Trader Collecting app from Topps can be downloaded for free from iTunes or Google Play. Be sure to download the app and start your collection today.
The Star Wars Digital Card Trader app from Topps is available now. And remember, these are the cards you're looking for.
Thank you so much, Dan and Corey. Definitely check out the Star Wars Trading Card app from Topps on your mobile device. Very fun thing. Great artwork. If you like just collecting images from all forms of Star Wars, whether it be animated or theatrical, definitely that's a great way to do it. And you don't have to spend a penny if you don't want to. Just get all the free credits. That's how I do it. So download it, enjoy it, have fun. And if you need somebody to trade with, let's trade. Let's do it. So definitely check that out. But let's jump back into Ghosts of Geonosis. Definitely we've had a good discussion so far, and a few more things we want to touch on before we wrap things up tonight. We want to go back into Saw Gerrera for a little bit, because he's got we talked about how much he's grown from the Clone Wars and how the differences between him and Rebels versus Rogue One. But he has some very, of course, interesting interactions in how he interacts with our crew in this episode, because of the way they want to handle things and predetermined notions of who he is and how he handles things obviously have played a role in it. And obviously the person that's going to give him the most latitude on things is the person he's known the longest, which of course is Rex. Rex helped train him in the Clone Wars and the Onderon arc, and that's even discussed early on in the episode on how Rex knows Saul. Definitely, you can see some camaraderie between the two. Almost an immediate trust, pretty much, when they get back face to face. How do you feel the relationship between Rex and Saw is at this moment, Dennis?
Well, yeah, they have that old war buddy vibe going on, for one thing. And then I also think Rex exhibits a certain amount of sympathy for Saw, because he knows what happened to Saw's sister, Stila, at the end of that Onderon arc, how, you know, they pretty much accomplished their goals. And then Stila died because of that Geonosian transport that attacked. So I don't think Rex approves of everything that Saw is doing, but he's got a sympathetic viewpoint that the rest of the Rebel crew just doesn't have, because they weren't there. They weren't familiar with him and his family and what was happening on Onderon.
Exactly. And Jay, thoughts?
Oh, I agree with Dennis completely. They were definitely reestablishing the bond that Rex and Saw had from way back in the Clone Wars days, so that they could tie that back together, not only with the storyline, but just with establishing, you know, a sense of trust too in this mission, which was one of the reasons why I think Rex was privy to the information even before Ezra was, you know, because he looked back at Rex and said, "You knew about this?" And, you know, there's Rex just kind of lounging in the back of the Ghost and, you know, basically said, "Well, yeah." So there's obviously that history there, and it's important. And that's why they brought Rex along, and obviously, you know, why he played a big role in finding Saw and being able to bring Saw back, knowing his kind of extreme attitude, I guess you could say, which of course ties it into Rogue One as well, to establish Saw as sort of an extremist. So it all fits together.
Exactly. Now, one thing I would look at too, of course, is Saw and Ezra. I mean, both have entered the rebellion and are fighting because of similar reasons. They both lost their family to the in war. Saw lost his sister to the separatists, and lost his planet to the Empire, as he says in the episode. Then, of course, Ezra, of course, lost his family. The Empire took his family, so that's why he got into the fight. But we see two different reactions to how they are going to fight the Empire at this point, based on honestly on probably who influenced them the most, and the people that they were surrounded by at the time. What do you see as the biggest similarity between Ezra and Saul, Jay?
Well, exactly what you just said, for sure. They both share a very common history in the things that they have lost and the reason that they came to the Empire. And, you know, and Ezra does have somewhat of an extreme personality as well. He likes to do things his way, even though he's kind of reined in by the rules and still has the same basic premise as far as fighting for the Alliance, fighting for the rebellion, and, you know, defeating the Empire. So of course there's that common thread that's there as well. But I think it's interesting that Saw at one point, when he was getting really angry, he basically said, "This war is the Jedi's fault. You know, it's the Jedi's fault." So, you know, I think that kind of hit home with Ezra and Kanan a little bit and kind of took him aback. It took me back a little bit, actually, because here he seemed to be okay with fighting alongside them. But when push came to shove, that's who he blamed for all of this. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
It was definitely an interesting line, because it definitely brings in a perspective that we had not seen, or we hadn't even thought about, honestly, till Saul said it. How much of this is going on is the Jedi's fault? I mean, they're the ones that were blinded to the fact that, and allowed Palpatine to take power, and that allowed them to get played. They got complacent, which, I mean, we can make a whole nother episode just discussing the ramifications of this whole war and the whole empire being the Jedi's fault. Dan, Corey, there's a topic for a future show. Feel free to run with it, because we don't have the time on reactions for it. but definitely it's something to that definitely he's got a point. I mean, if it wasn't for the Jedi, where would what situation would be? Dennis?
Well, I've got a problem with that, because he was fighting with the Jedi against the Separatists, and the Jedi were not fighting against the Republic and what became the Empire at that time. And he was squarely throwing the blame for losing the war on the Jedi. And so to me, the anger seemed misplaced. Because he was saying, you're all soft and you're the reason we lost the war. It's like, well, what is exactly does he mean by that? Because they didn't lose the war. Unfortunately, the Empire took over after the Republic won the war. And, this is a different war that we're talking about. And so, I don't know. I think to him, it was maybe he means that way back in the day, if things had gone differently with Anakin and Ahsoka, then Onderon would have been settled in a different manner and Steela wouldn't be gone and he wouldn't have that. But, there aren't Jedi around right now. It's Kanan and Ezra, and they're a secret from a large part of the Alliance. They aren't really known throughout the entire Empire. So they aren't on the front lines leading this war. So to me, his anger seems a little bit misplaced. Yeah, there is a larger point that if the Jedi had been on top of things, then maybe the Sith never would have ascended. But at this point, the galaxy doesn't even know that Palpatine's a Sith. They only know about Darth Vader. I'm not certain that he's being rational. Oh, I know he's not being rational in this point.
Yeah, he's looking for an emotional scapegoat is what he's looking for. But, I think some of that, too, goes back to the fact that you're right with Onderon. If it would have gone a different way, because the whole reason that they were fighting was because at the time they didn't want to join the Separatists. They didn't want to join the Republic. They didn't want to do anything. They just wanted to be left alone. And so they were almost convinced to join the Republic by fighting against the Separatists and then ultimately became part of the Empire. And so maybe he's laying the blame on the Jedi for that in a roundabout way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think, unfortunately, this is a very hard problem. He was always an extremist, and he was willing to strike out at the Separatists on Onderon before he even knew what he was doing. And mm-hmm. It took a lot of guidance and patience from the Jedi to help him fight effectively. And now he's learned how to do that, but he's a quick learner, and he's seeing everything that's going on around him, the atrocities that the Empire commit, and the rebellion at this point has largely been ineffective. The first battle that is referred to in the opening crawl for New Hope, the first victory by the rebellion, hasn't occurred yet. And so, he wants progress. He wants results. And this fighting nicely isn't working for the rebellion. And so, he's willing to torture an innocent Geonosian. He's willing to fight dirty. And I'm afraid he's willing to use that poison that they discover. And, so he's not held back by the same ethics that Mon Mothma and some of the others are. And that I think, and maybe that's why he's angry with the Jedi. They aren't willing to go that extra step to definitively win this war. They've got shackles that he's not willing to use and to keep. And therefore, they weren't going, he doesn't believe that they're capable of winning.
Well, very good. Very good. And definitely you bring up some valid points there. I mean, because obviously he is a very emotional wreck. He's an emotional wreck at that point when he has that speech. So definitely is a lot to think about when we're talking about Saul Guerrero, because he's definitely been very fleshed out so far. There's a lot more we can still see from him. So do you think that we'll see him again later in the series?
Oh, I definitely think we will, for sure. There's a lot of unanswered questions at this point. And, there's things also that do either or both of you have the visual guide for Rogue One?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It gives you some hints as far as where Rebels might actually take him. And I'd love to see how his storyline crosses paths with Galen's. I mean, do you think that we'll see Galen in Rebels at all?
I don't. At this point, he's on an Imperial facility working on the Death Star, or at least he should be. Lyra is no longer around. I think maybe we're more likely to see Jen than Galen, but you know, there's a lot that's about to happen to Saw, because you know we're not that far away from the events of Rogue One, and he's a very different man in a very short period of time. So, right. You know, whether that happens in Rebels or a novel or a comic book, you know, there's a lot that's about to happen to him.
Very true.
And that, I know that was when the poster first came out, that where we saw a glimpse of the animated Saw, that was a discussion that came up, was how different he looked in that poster and in Rebels compared to Rogue One, because it's a very different person, very different man, in a very short time frame, and how much of a conflict war takes its toll on people. There's no doubt on that. That's well established. Can you just imagine what this man has been through in the approximately two years between this and Rogue One to become the man he is in Rogue One? Just imagine the pressure and the fight and the stress of it all that he's had to deal with in that short time frame. It's enough to any weaker. I mean, he's probably out there. He's got his, he's a little strung out, a little crazy. You can see that in Rogue One. But a weaker man would have broke under the in what obviously was a very stressful situation for most people.
Yeah, and Saw's emotions run deep. I mean, you can tell he wears his heart on his sleeve most of the time, but yet there's also that part of him that you don't quite see, and you wonder what's going on in his head and in his heart. And he did kind of freak me out a little bit, and I cringed a few times when he was dealing with Click Clack and threatening to terminate the egg, the queen, so to speak. And, you know, it just kind of made me cringe a little bit to think, yeah, I knew that he was extreme, but, you know, is he capable of full out genocide? I don't know.
Well, you know,
go ahead, Dennis.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, you know, just listening to you talk made me think of a couple things. I was finishing up the novelization for Rogue One today on my commute home on the train, and it made me remember that when in the novelization, when Jen first gets to his group on Jeddah, she's asking after people she knew that fought with Saw, and they're all gone. They all died. So I can't help but wonder if maybe some of these people were on this mission with Saw. To Geonosis. And second, I probably need to take back the idea that we'll see Jen at this point. You know, Saw left her behind, I suspect, to protect her, that reference. But, you know, and, you know, maybe that's part of his issue, is the guilt of, you know, what he had to do to protect her. He had to leave her behind, even though he thought he was doing the best thing. You know, as he mentions in Rogue One, you know, people were beginning to suspect who she was. And so he had to leave her behind because he knew she could take care of herself. Well, did he believe that? Is that eating away at him at this point? You know, that in order, you know, the, you know, Steele, he makes references that, you know, that was all he had, was his sister, and he lost her. Well, then he had an adopted daughter, and he had to leave her behind for her, you know, for her best interest. So, you know, everyone that's close to him, you know, the Ursos and his sister are gone. They're no longer part of his life.
What thing we want to shift gears on, I want to bring up another topic here, because there's a lot in this episode still to review, and we're starting to run a little short on time here, but we're going to hit as much of it as we can. I want to talk about Hera. You know, Hera's of course been our pilot through thick and thin, through all three seasons. And we see her do a fair amount of phenomenal flying as she's guiding the ghost through a hole that's the size of the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
How good of a pilot do you have to be not to run into a wall at that point?
It's like threading a, you know, needle, basically. And we know that Hera is good, but this just proved just how good, for sure.
Oh, yeah. It was very impressive. Because she, I mean, just guided it down slowly but surely. Of course, even as they're being shot at by these jump troopers, and she's got crew on the roof of the ghost defending the ship. And, I mean, she held it steady, had no problem guiding it down. And I'm still impressed. She really never hit anything. Which brings me to the question, where did all those bridges go?
She crushed them on the way down the first time.
She did. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love about Hera is that many of my favorite characters in Star Wars are the pilots, so the cocky, confident pilots, Han Solo, Poe Dameron, and her. And she never doubts her abilities, ever. Last season we got to see her test pilot the B-Wing, and, you know, she was born to fly that, and, you know, she convinced, I wish I could remember the Mon Cal's name, that build thing, based on her speech about flying and her love for doing it. I'm not a pilot and I don't want to be, but in this episode, she tells everyone to strap in and, they make a run for it up that chasm. And she never for a second doubts her abilities that she's going to get them out of there. And, it might be tight. One of her most frequent lines, I think, in the entire series is hold on, because she's always telling people to do that because of the messes that they find themselves in, and that she has to come up with a fancy maneuver to do it. But, her confidence never wavers when it comes to getting the ghost through something.
Well, she's like an artist. Her ship is an extension of herself, just as the paintbrush is the extension of the artist. It's part of her. She's a part of it. And it doesn't matter if it's the ghost or what she's piloting. Like you said, Dennis, she's just confident. It's what she does. And she does it so well.
She does it very well. And it's one of those situations where she doesn't let it. I mean, she doesn't even break a sweat flying in that down that hole. It's almost like it's second nature to her. And the Mon Calamari you were talking about, his name was Quarry.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. He built the B-Wing, but it proves just how good of a pilot they are. And obviously this proves that, that when it comes to flying there, she's really unmatched. I would put her up against I'd put her up against Han any day after seeing her fly through this hole. Han was always my favorite. He was always what I considered the top echelon of pilots when it came to Star Wars. But after seeing this, Hera just took the throne, I think, from him.
Well, she wasn't given command of Phoenix Squadron just because she was a good leader. She was a phenomenal pilot, and she earned it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's no doubt of that. And definitely it's a well-earned position for her. Though we need to discuss Imperials, because we do have Imperials as, of course, the enemies in the Star Wars universe. We always have Imperials showing up, and we have a light cruiser that shows up after a proximity alert is triggered, and they show up just to investigate. And it's led by, of course, a Captain Brunson, who, of course, once she realizes the ghost is there, is out for a promotion at this point, and uses some of her better judgment, don't you think, Jay?
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, as we were saying earlier too, was it Sabine or Hera, which one that made the comment that she obviously doesn't know her ship very well or doesn't know what she's doing? She's inexperienced, because as they were coming up from underneath, there must be a weak spot in the underbelly of these ships that even Brunson didn't know about, that they were able to do what they did.
Exactly. I mean, when I sat there and I watched it for the first time, my first reaction was, how did they blow a ship that big in half? Because they did it with relatively ease, just all the forward blasters going and a couple proton torpedoes. And that,
but they did lose the insecticide too. Could that have had something to do with it?
Well, the insecticide didn't blow. It just fell back. Looked like
it just fell.
It looks like it just fell back toward the planet.
Okay,
it got knocked loose. It wasn't something that. Honestly, it looked like that happened prior to. I'd have to rewatch the scene again, but if I remember correctly, I thought that happened prior to them exiting the cave. But I could be wrong on that.
Well, you know, the other thing is that I'm not sure these light cruisers are all they're cracked up to be. We saw the Iron Squadron with the, as Zeb likes to put it, the ship full of Ezras take out a light cruiser with a cargo container packed with some explosives. And then it made the B-Wing seem a little less impressive, you know, because Hera destroyed one with the weapons on the B-Wing. They are good for getting some forces around, but they just don't seem to hold up in the long run. Those light cruisers have started to replace that transport that Kallus was using a lot in the first season with a frequency. But I almost wonder if this perhaps wouldn't have been because those transports carry a couple TIE fighters. Maybe that would have been a better choice as a Imperial, you know, cruiser type class vehicle for this episode, and maybe would have seemed I don't know, maybe that just wouldn't have been quite the challenger, quite the threat to the crew of the Ghost. But those light cruisers just don't seem to stand up anymore.
No, they don't. They seem to be very flimsy, but and they just blow up at the most random times too. They're not very, very effective. Jay?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it seems like the Empire is definitely focused on more quantity than quality. I never did understand why they couldn't put shields, especially on TIE bombers. I can see TIE fighters, but why not put shields on TIE bombers? Those things are easy to take off. They just pick them right off.
True. Honestly, if we're going to go that into it, I mean, why not put better shields around the bridges of your ships? Especially let's say a Star Destroyer, before an A-Wing flies into it and you crash into a Death Star.
Imperial arrogance.
There's a lot of, and you're exactly right. I know that's why if you do your research, that's why they say they switched to the TIE fighters over some of the old Republic fighters that they used to use, because they could be produced inexpensively and quickly and in quantity. And definitely it's one of those, the more numbers, you're more likely to frighten people into submission via number, the amount of numbers you have versus the amount of the quality that you have, which I think that's why they had so much issue, of course, with disbanding the Senate after they got the Death Star. Is, of course, that it was more of a power play versus a quantity. They only had the one. One space station could only be at one place at one point. How do you keep order in that way? Fear? Okay, fear. Okay, fine. You blow up that planet. Yeah, I'm going to be afraid of you, but if you start coming to mine, I know you're coming. I'm going to leave.
True. Hightail it out of there.
I can find another planet. This is Star
Wars. But can everybody? I mean, that's a lot of people to relocate from planet to planet.
I'll move to Coruscant. They're not going to blow that up. Well, at least not till later, I guess. But it's one of those things that definitely is interesting through the bit. But that light cruiser was very, back to the point we were talking about, blew up in my eyes way too flimsy. Brunson, it was cool to see a new commander. It's always good to see them utilize, female characters too in command. And unfortunately, this one didn't make the best decisions. The cruiser was just not built that well. I gotta say, these suckers can't be built well at all, obviously. Or maybe it came off a line like in off of Lothal, where somebody's sabotaging it somewhere.
Mm.
Yeah, I like that idea. I also like the captain of the cruiser. A lot of people were suspecting it was maybe someone we'd seen before, whether it was Ray Sloan or whatever. But I like that in this season of Rebels that the captains and commanders of the various starships are not the stereotypical officer with a cap pulled down over their eyes every time, that they are getting a chance to illustrate and animate characters that, you know, I guess maybe they have more of a budget. I'm not sure. But they, you know, we get to see them. We get to see their eyes. We get to see their facial expressions. They're not all voiced by Steve Bloom or, you know, one of the other regulars on the cast. But they're getting more variety to the people than the Empire. You know, as diverse as the Rebels have become, they're starting to show more diversity in the Empire as well.
I agree with you totally, Dennis. And I think a lot of that, too, is maybe because they're trying to personalize the Empire just a little bit more, where that, like, as you said, not everyone has the cap pulled down over the eyes now, so that they all don't just look alike. Kind of going back to the Geonosians, they all kind of, you know, look like bugs, and the Imperials just kind of look like bugs. So, you know, now we can almost get invested in these characters in a way, so that you can see both sides of the story. And maybe by investing in them, you also feel more towards them instead of, oh, they're just Imperials, so they're all evil. Whereas, yeah, they're still the bad guys, quote unquote, but now we kind of know them in a way. So it makes you even more invested in the story.
Humanizing the enemy.
The other thing is that every time you saw an Imperial with a cap pulled down over its eyes, you knew they weren't going to be successful. And so at least for a moment, I mean, this captain was not successful, and she made some bad decisions. She let her ambition get the best of her, because I think she said something like, oh, that's the ghost. Well, if we can take out the ghost, we're all going to eat promotions, or something to that effect. But at least from the moment she came on screen, we didn't assume incompetence. You know, this was somebody different. It didn't look like everything else, every other officer that we'd seen. You know, she kept her officers in line and, you know, issued harsh orders and got to be verbose. And, you know, again, she was ultimately not successful, but we didn't have an assumption to run with her from the get-go.
Exactly. Yeah, all these other Imperial officers were like red shirts in Star Trek, right, Aaron? Yes!
There's a Star Trek reference for the
night. There it is.
And you're dead on with that, too. And I like
expendable.
What you said. Exactly. And I like what you said, Dennis. I mean, because she definitely, I mean, when she first came on the screen, she was a very likable character. I mean, you could see success in her future. And this just was not the day. And she definitely seemed very bright, very in control. I mean, and very in command. And definitely, they are definitely making these characters a lot more human. And I'm thoroughly enjoying that. Even back on the episode, in the past episodes, we're starting to see them humanize them more and more and more, and giving the Empire more of a face than what we're used to seeing. I mean, the face of the Empire has always been the white stormtrooper helmet and Darth Vader. And now we're getting commanders, we're getting Kallus, we're actually getting humans that we can actually relate to and that are fighting for the other side, which is definitely just added a new dimension to Star Wars in and of itself.
Well, even in Revenge of the Sith, in the opening crawl, one of the lines was, there are heroes on both sides. And even in the Empire, you know, no one thinks that they're evil. They think that they're doing the best for their personal beliefs that they can possibly do. So if you take that same philosophy, you know, the Empire believed that they were doing things for the right reasons, and the people that went into the Empire serving them in different capacities believed that they were serving a higher purpose as well, and not just a bad one.
exactly. And definitely it's going to be fun to see where they carry this in the future, and see how they continue to humanize the Empire going forward. Mm-hmm. So, but definitely we've had a lot of fun with this episode. Ghosts of Geonosis has been a lot of fun. It was a lot very exciting episode to see. I know it was one I was looking forward to personally. We'll start with you, Dennis. What are your final thoughts here on Ghosts of Geonosis?
It was a great return after the mid-season break. I'm really glad that they didn't waste any time tying it right into Rogue One. Forest Whitaker was a great addition to the cast, if only for these two episodes. It was a great return. I can't help but feel a little frustrated, not in a negative way, that the secret of the Death Star was there for them to discover if they only could communicate with Clank better. They made so many stabs at guessing at what he was trying to illustrate. And maybe one of those things was the answer, but everything that came after was right there within their grasp, and they just couldn't do it. And unfortunately they just had no way of knowing. At the end they thought they had discovered the secret with the poison. And, it's really just a red herring at the end of the day. So good episode. I was really pleased with it.
Very good. Jay?
Oh, yeah. As Dennis said, it was a great way to jump right back in. I was looking forward to this one. And, because there were some, and I know, Aaron, this is not going to make you happy for me to say this, but there were some episodes that you kind of just thought, where is this going? And I know everything has a purpose and everything has a reason, but this was definitely one I could just jump right on board with and, make those connections and get excited about, because obviously there's some loose threads that we're going to be tying up later on. And I can't wait to see where those threads end up getting tied. So I really enjoyed it.
Well, I agree with you both. This is a great way to come back from the mid-season break, from the holidays. A great way to tie it into Rogue One. Forest Whitaker was great portraying the younger Saw, we'll say. The more not as war-torn Saw. He voiced him quite well. We had a lot of fun, a lot of quips through the episode, whether it was the sand comment that from Sabine or Rex telling Saw that he's no Skywalker. There's a lot of little great quips, and of course, Chopper's in it. So anytime Chopper's in something, it's going to be great.
Of course.
Yeah, I was very disappointed Chopper did not win a Golden Globe for his best supporting actor for Rogue One. But you know what? I'll file my complaint with the foreign press later. But definitely should have won. But hey, it was a great episode all around. A lot of fun, a lot of exciting things, a lot of questions still. I agree with you, Dennis. It was very frustrating to sit there and know that, if they would have had a protocol droid.
Yeah. Yeah.
A New Hope would have been completely different. Rogue One would have been completely different because they would have known from the Death Star from that point. If all they had was a protocol droid.
And, so true.
It's just, so many hints right there through this episode, whether it's the multiple times he drew it in the sand or the one piece behind him in that one scene. It's just an incredible, incredible fun episode all the way around. Of course, we do grade the episodes as well, and we want to go right into it. And since we started with Dennis before, we'll start with you, Jay. Let's go ahead and grade Ghost of Geonosis.
Oh, I definitely give it an A. And I do think that there's a lot of room for parents, especially since obviously Rebels is a cartoon and kids are going to be watching this, that could open up some great discussion about certain ethical standards and points of view and, why Saw did things the way that he did and why he handled things and how he handled things. And what do you think about that? And, my kids are older now, they're teenagers, but I'm always thinking about that in the back of my mind because, I raised my own kids on Star Wars. And so what conversations would I have with my own children? And I do think that this would really open the doors for a lot of that great discussion. But I also give it the A for just a lot of those tie-ins that we see obviously going backward and forward, backward to Clone Wars, forward to Rogue One, and just how it all fits together. And for those of us, of course, that are huge, huge fans, we appreciate all of those little tie-ins. So definitely an A for me.
Very good. Dennis?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a great episode. I'm going to give it an A minus only because there was two episodes early this season that I liked a lot that I gave an A. And it just liked a little bit better than this one. It's a great story. I loved how clever and creative the creative staff was coming up with this episode and putting, like I mentioned earlier, just putting that answer there for the Rebels that was just out of their grasp. They just didn't know what a question to ask. And you're right. Having a protocol droid would have made all the difference in the world. But great performance by Whitaker and continued great performances by, Vanessa Marshall, Taylor Gray, T.S. Sakaar, Freddie Prinze Jr., Steve Bloom, the whole cast. They continue to knock it out of the park every episode. So A-. Good job.
Very good. Very good. I have to agree. For me, this was an A. I did thoroughly enjoy this episode. It was the perfect intro from the off season or from the mid-break season. It definitely was a lot of exciting factors through there. We got to see a lot of growth in a couple of our characters when it comes to Sabine. And, of course, when we get to see Hera's piloting skills and obviously how mad crazy her flying skills are. Then of course we get to see Rex reunite with Saul and just Saul's character as a whole, as it was just great. And it worked out perfectly and gave us a lot of insight on that rift growing between him and the actual Alliance. And definitely hope it's something we explore more and see exactly we know the rift is there, but what exactly led to the break? What was that breaking point? I hope we get to see that eventually. Although this was definitely a strain and there's already been strain in that relationship there, I don't see this being the one thing that broke him away from the Alliance and the Alliance cutting him off because of this one thing. There's got to be something else that's happened and I want to see what it is. And hopefully we'll get to see that eventually. So definitely all around great episode. Definitely thoroughly enjoyed it. Can't wait for the next one, Warhead, when it comes out next week. So be on the lookout for that. Of course, Dennis, if somebody wants to continue their Star Wars discussion with you off the air, where would they go to do that, sir?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle there is DJKVER2. I'm also co-host of Starship Sabers and Scoundrels. The Twitter account for that is SCubePod. We have a lot of discussions there as well. So look me up in either place.
Very good. Jay?
Well, you can most likely find me on Twitter, and I am at Joyce Krebs, JoyceKrebs. You can always email me at Coffee with Kenobi, and my email address there is jayk at coffeewithkenobi.com. And I'm hoping to get some more reviews out here soon, some more fashion reviews for the Core Worlds Couture piece that I do for Coffee with Kenobi. It's been kind of crazy, crazy days here lately. So now that the holidays are over, got some pieces to review. So look for those there as well on Coffee with Kenobi.
Very good. Very good. And of course, you can always, if you want to get a hold of me, the best way to get a hold of me is through Twitter at TA Harris 121079. Or of course, email me aharris@coffeewithkenobi.com. Follow the show, Rebels Reactions. We're on Twitter at Rebels Reactions. You can email your thoughts on this episode or, of course, on the next episode coming out, Warhead, when it finally airs. Email your thoughts to Rebels Reactions at coffeewithkenobi.com. The more, Chris, send us your thoughts so we could use them in that future episode as well. You never know. Just send them in. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. Jay, Dennis, pleasure having you on. Definitely thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. Look forward to possibly doing this again with you both in the future again. So definitely we'll do it again. Definitely check out coffeewithkenobi.com. A lot of great shows there. Besides Rebels Reactions, of course, the flagship show, Coffee with Kenobi. We have Comics with Kenobi. If you like comics, if you like the old Legends line of books, we have Legends Library. And, of course, we have the Lattes with Leia, which is phenomenal fangirl perspective. So definitely some great shows and some phenomenal blogs on the website as well. Check them all out there at coffeewithkenobi.com. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Thank you so much for following. We look forward to next time. And remember, this is the podcast you're looking for.
Well, kid, you pulled it off.
Was there ever any doubt?
Yes.
Chopper, get us out of here.
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email or MP3 at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com, or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the Contact Us section or comment on one of the stories featured on the site. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes or Stitcher. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi, as well as keep up to date at our Twitter feed at @coffeewithkenobi. You can also find us on Tumblr at coffeewithkenobi.tumblr.com. If you enjoy the jazz music, the album is Eye to Eye by Steve Torak.
This is Spectre One. I need a lift.
This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm Limited. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names, sounds, and any other Star Wars-related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney and their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi unless otherwise indicated.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
There's no one here. Move along.
If you love Star Wars and love the excitement of chasing your favorite Star Wars collectibles, the Star Wars Digital Card Trader collecting app from Topps is for you. Download the free app from iTunes or Google Play and collect your favorite images from the classic 1977 Star Wars cards to Clone Wars, Star Wars Rebels, The Force Awakens, and much more. Collect and trade with friends new and old through the Star Wars Digital Card Trader collecting app from Topps. These are the cards you're looking for.